Before your podcast, to put your headphones on. Headphones on.
Put your headphones on.
You take your headphones off, you put your headphones on.
All right. So let's just jump right in.
Yeah. Are we doing the thing, that, or are we doing a lead up?
Well, we don't have much time today.
Yeah, no, today's a little pressed.
We're a little pressed for time, and we didn't have a lot to report. We didn't get a walk in.
No, I think I'm, just plugging along with our lives.
Just plugging along with our lives. I feel that way, too. This has
eating
been...
eating the food, changing the diapers, washing laundry.
Yeah, it's been a busy week, feeling a little discouraged. Oh, you and I went to a socialist get-together, meet-up in Adrian.
And it was just us. Which was kind of crazy.
So, well, we were supposed to meet some of the DSA, Huron Valley DSA folks there.
Yeah.
Either we went to the wrong place or they had left already or something.
We don't really know.
But we didn't feel disappointed because we got to hang out in this little donut shop in Adrian.
For
a while. And it was so peaceful and quiet that you and I got a chance to chat in a way that we haven't in a long time.
For months,
we were talking about, okay, our plans for the house, what are we going to do with all this life stuff that's happening that involves some complicated trade-offs and decision-making, especially regarding the old house.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we have a plan now.
You have some plan. Yeah.
I feel immeasurably better having had a chance to talk through all the things that are really making me anxious.
And what's weighing on you.
And weighing on me.
So it was actually serendipitous.
Yeah. It was nice that it would have been good to see everyone, but we still needed to have...
we needed to do that. It was good. And I also kind of renewed my sense to... make sure we get a chance to do that frequently.
We need to do it more often because very often Grace and I only get to talk to each other in very short bursts. And I mean, when we're at home, even in the evening, trying to get ready for bed, we rarely, I think, can speak for more than a minute, literally 1 minute without an interruption.
Right.
Yeah.
So
it's very hard under those circumstances to get to the things that are really...
get to the meat of the conversation.
Bothering us and that needs some thought. And and if we do get into like a topic that's maybe upsetting or something, we might be, we're not yelling at each other, but we might be like, waving our arms and gesticulating and like talking emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the kids are like, are you guys going to get a divorce?
If so, what's going on?
We're not even fighting.
We're not even fighting, guys.
We're just like talking about an upsetting topic and venting, even at each other, just like venting.
In the room, like in general.
To witness for each other, right?
They don't actually know what a fighting looks like.
They don't know what a fight looks like, because honestly, if we're really having a fight, we're probably not talking to each other.
Like really not talking.
Yeah, so anyway.
I think we've only, as what, two?
I had two fights in our whole...
Yeah, I think we've only had two fights, really.
Two like I'd call bad fights, and occasionally
a tiff. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We are pressed for time, so I think we're going to talk today about one article.
One article.
And try and get through
that's
it.
That's the update we've got.
Yeah, try to get through it in a relatively... expeditious way, although it is a big topic.
It's a big topic. It's a long article to the New Yorker, the Annals of Medicine, February 5th, 2018. What does it mean to die?
Yeah, so why don't you introduce this? Because I did just read it, but I was rushing, and you've had a little more time to sit with it.
Well, yeah, and also I've been following this story since the beginning.
Yeah, okay. I had not heard about this girl. And her
So in 2013, a young woman named Jahi McMath went in for a tonsillectomy at Children's Hospital in Oakland. And she did make it out, so to speak.
A tonsillectomy is supposed to be a really common, safe operation for children.
For decades.
They do it frequently. I had one in the early 70s, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I remember they gave me ice cream. My throat was sore for a couple days. I went home, right?
Yeah, it's unremarkable.
I'm old enough that they probably used ether.
Oh.
At the time.
Yes, they
right?
probably did. Yes.
In the, you know, to anesthetize me. Right.
So, something went wrong. What is not clear. And her heart stopped post-operatively. She recovered from surgery and was awake and conscious again and eating again, but then, like, had a popsicle. But was coughing up blood for several hours, and then her heart stopped. And it took them 2.5 hours to resuscitate.
Several hours in, and she was bleeding a lot. She was filling up a container, like 200 milliliters of blood. And someone had a note in her chart that she had this sort of physiological abnormality where her aorta was very, very close to her trachea.
Maybe.
The article doesn't claim it one way or the other because the New Yorker doesn't want to get sued.
Right.
But somebody nicked her aorta and she was bleeding heavily after this surgery.
And then at one point her heart stopped. It took them 2.5 hours to get her breathing and get her stabilized. And when they got her stabilized, she had suffered some significant amount of brain damage.
Yeah.
And
she needed to be placed on a ventilator.
Right. She needed to be placed on a ventilator.
When they removed the breathing tube, she wouldn't start
breathing
on her own.
Right. And they declared her brain dead, and her family was uncomfortable with that diagnosis and also just kind of bewildered as to how a tonsillectomy comes out like this.
Yeah. They were neglecting her. And I believe that this is just, from what I've read recently and experienced too, went through with friends and relatives, is
right.
Hospitals just neglect black patients
straight
horribly.
Just straight up.
Yeah. They don't see them as people.
It's like, oh, we've got some livestock here. I guess we'll do whatever.
They don't show the same level of concern and attention to them, especially post-operatively,
yes,
that they do to white patients. That seems to be borne out by the statistics.
And that appears to just be the deal.
Yeah, and it's horrifying, you know.
Yeah.
But this is what one of the things we mean when we say racism can kill you.
It can actually just kill you.
Yeah.
So they declared her brain dead. The family contested it, so to speak, and hired an attorney and pressed the hospital to provide her the care so she could recover. The hospital insisted, no, she's dead. We're not going to provide this care.
Yeah.
And they were kind of at a stalemate. Finally, their agreement they reached is that the hospital would release her to the coroner. The coroner would declare her dead, and then they could take her.
Just think about what that, like the contradictions that this entails.
Right, what this means. Which is, I get basically the hospital is saying, we're not going to do anything differently. Perhaps the only concession the hospital's making in that agreement is not to remove the ventilator.
Right. That was about it.
That's the only concession the hospital.
And they were saying, you know, we want a written record that our liability is limited.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what the hospital's saying. We want a written record that our liability is limited. Have a nice day.
Yeah, they were telling her so.
Yeah, you highlighted a thing.
I highlighted a lot of things, but okay. I'm not going to try and read them all. But yeah, so the social workers were urging the family repeatedly to make plans for taking her off the ventilator and donating her organs.
Yeah.
And the family was saying, we want to know what happened to her before we'll consider anything like
about that. We'll explain what happened here.
They wanted her medical records.
Wouldn't get into her.
And they would allow the family to look at her records, but not take them, you know, away.
Oh, right, not to have the records, right?
Or copy them, which I've run into this. I've run into the same kind of stonewalling over records too.
Right, that's a thing.
It's a thing, right? Even when I had a durable medical power of attorney.
Yeah, I'm not giving you the records. Sorry.
Right, and the family kept saying, you know, she's warm, she moves, you know, and how, you know, why are you calling her dead? And the doctors were saying this is like a spinal reflex.
Spinal reflex. And just insisting that, you know, she's dead, and I don't want to put engage the illusion that she's not dead.
They also were saying, well, basically she's going to start to decay if you just leave her on the ventilator. And then she, quote, won't look good for the funeral.
Right. She's going to start to actually decompose.
Yeah.
If you just leave her on the ventilator. And yes, and then won't look good for the funeral. As if that's, and I think
that's of course, you know, they treated her family like children.
Yes,
they were very condescending and very belittling to them, to their concerns, insulting.
Right, and, as if they didn't comprehend that the family is literally bewildered as to how this could happen.
Right,
like so, what happened? What went wrong? So that she's now, you're describing her as dead now.
Yeah,
after this.
Yeah,
whereas they're like, oh, she's dead now. Let's move on.
So, say something about the cap on liability. Right?
Oh, that's an interesting thing. And this was actually, I think, this is the reason they got any traction at all.
Yeah.
They hired this personal, this personal injury lawyer agreed to take the case pro bono.
Right.
And his first thing, the very first step, he said, listen, the hospital can't unplug her because that limits their liability to $250,000. There's a cap on liability for hospitals in California.
Mm-hmm.
So if the patient dies, the most the hospital is liable for is $250,000. It's unlimited if the patient is still alive.
Yes. Yeah.
So the hospital has a vested interest in the coroner calling her dead.
In declaring her dead.
The hospital has a significant vested interest in declaring her dead and in unplugging the ventilator.
And so this attorney, Christopher Dolan,
yes.
His sense was, the article says, as a self-described cafeteria Catholic, he acted on a vague feeling that a child with a beating heart is not entirely dead.
So, you know.
Yeah.
And really, that was his first line of defense, was to get an injunction.
So he got an injunction so that the hospital could not just...
Just pull the plug. Like, you know... The family's not there. They unplug her and they come back and she's dead.
And he had to fight for that.
Yes.
And he had to, repeatedly fight for it.
Go back to court and go back to court.
Right.
Go back to court and get an extension
before
they made this agreement that, okay, we won't pull off the ventilator, but she's going straight to the coroner for a declaration of death.
Right.
From there, they moved her to a care facility in New Jersey. And I should note, New York and New Jersey are the only two states in the United States where the family does not have to embrace a declaration of brain death for religious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And those laws exist in New York and New Jersey because of the Orthodox Jewish population.
So they did this study called radionuclide cerebral blood flow study.
Yeah.
And according to that study, which was before they released her, they did not see any
brain activity,
any blood flow
through the brain, right?
Yeah, they weren't looking for electrical activity.
Correct.
They were looking for cerebral blood flow. So they claimed that basically that this was a white void, a whiteout in the part of the head where the brain is.
Right. There's no blood going there.
So.
That's the hospital's claim, which I don't see any grounds to reject that, except for their self-interest.
Their medical ethics committee said that no conceivable goal of medicine, preserving life, curing disease, restoring function, or alleviating suffering can be achieved by continuing to ventilate and artificially support a deceased patient. So they insisted on calling her dead.
Yes, that was, yes. An absolute insistence on her deceased state.
Yeah.
So the move to New Jersey allowed them to get into a hospital that would provide her, would perform a tracheotomy so she could breathe more safely.
Yep.
Provide her a feeding tube so she could actually get nourishment.
Right. So her physical condition was deteriorating in a manner that was kind of...
was consistent with what the hospital described.
But she had not received any nutrition for three weeks. And you're going to look kind of a little...
It's going to stress your body out.
A little sallow.
You're not going to look well after 3 weeks without any food.
Right, right.
So this new hospital in New Jersey, they installed a tracheotomy. They performed a tracheotomy and installed a feeding tube. And after a significant lapse of time, like a month or so, she started to look better.
Right. So
she actually started to recover physically.
So these laws, mm-hmm. tell us about this variation in the law.
Oh, I was kind of starting to mention that just a moment ago.
Sorry. How we're a little disorganized.
In New York and New Jersey.
Yeah.
The family is not required to say, okay, the person's dead.
Right.
Accept that diagnosis. So in other words, it's basically a religious exemption for embracing that definition of brain death.
For who?
For families of patients who've been declared brain dead.
Well, the article says basically it was the laws in both states were written to accommodate Orthodox Jews.
Yes.
In specific.
That's what initiated the existence of the law. Anyone can use the law.
Yes.
Anyone can use that law in the state of New Jersey. You don't have to be an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
To use it. But the law is written to accommodate Orthodox Jews in both states. The population is large enough that it's a thing. They get representation.
But the Talmudic notion of life, of being alive.
That you breathe at all.
Is that you breathe.
Right. You're breathing at all. So as long as someone's breathing at all, they're considered to be alive, even if it's artificial breathing.
Yeah.
And it's basically a religious exemption law in those two states. Right?
Yes.
So anyone gets to claim that exemption and say, well, she's still breathing. She's not dead. We want her to receive care X, Y, and Z. So they did. And that hospital had her, I think, for at least three months, maybe possibly as long as six. Mm-hmm. But she was in that hospital for many, many months. And in that time, she began to recover physically. So like some of the bloating and deterioration reversed.
Yes, yeah.
She began menstruating.
Yeah, she was 13 when she went in for surgery.
Right.
She was on the cusp of her first period.
Puberty, right.
Yeah, of entering puberty.
And so her grandmother's like, she started menstruating. You should note that in her record. And they're like, we don't know why that's happening.
That's not menstruation. She's just bleeding from her vagina and nowhere else for some reason.
For 5 days and then it stops.
So, there's Arthur Kaplan, founding director of NYU Division of Medical Ethics, mm-hmm. Mentioned as perhaps the best known bioethicist in the country, wrote that keeping her on a ventilator amounts to desecration of a body. He's saying you can't feed a corpse. She's going to start to decompose. The Lawrence McCullough, a professor of medical ethics at Cornell, criticized any hospital that would admit Jahi. What could they be thinking? He said to USA Today. There's a word for this, crazy.
Crazy.
Right.
Oh, it's child abuse.
It's child abuse, right? But then they do quote a few people who were bioethicists, mm-hmm. who say, wait a minute, this is out of hand.
And you're just
they're troubled by the tone, especially, right?
Right.
So Robert Truog, director of the Center for Bioethics at Harvard, said, I think the bioethics community felt the need to support the traditional understanding of brain death.
I would say conventional understanding.
I'm just quoting.
Yes.
To the point that they were really treating, conventional in the modern convention, not really traditional.
Not really traditional. Right.
To the point that they were really treating the family with disdain. Truog thought that the social context of the family's decision had been ignored. African Americans twice as likely as whites to ask that their lives be prolonged
as much as possible,
even in the case of irreversible coma, a preference that likely stems from fears of neglect. A large body of research has shown that black patients are less likely to get appropriate medications and surgeries than white ones, regardless of their insurance and education, and are more likely to receive undesirable medical interventions like
amputations.
Yeah. And he said, doctor is saying your loved one is dead and your loved one doesn't look dead. I understand it might feel that once again, you're not getting the right care because of the color of your skin.
Right.
Right. I believe that she was basically being treated as a welfare queen, right?
Yes.
You know, that this girl is wasting valuable resources.
Valuable tax, pair of dollars.
She just, she's sponging off.
Come on.
That the family's doing it for attention.
And all these really disparaging things that if you acknowledge the context are really racist things to even think.
So talk a little bit about our contemporary concept of what comprises death, Like, what's agreed on by the current medical establishment as comprising death?
The current medical establishment has centered around this concept called brain death.
Right. Yeah.
So they examine your brain function, and if your brain function is kind of flatlined, you're not, as far as they can tell, you're not responding to stimuli. Like they said, their pupils didn't dilate. They dropped water in her ear. She didn't respond. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of tests, right? That, like, these reflexes that indicate that your brain, on a very low level, is able to function and fire.
It's doing the stuff that it normally does.
Right. And then if you're not responding to those tests, they understand you to be what they call brain dead.
Even if most of your organs,
all the rest of your organs are functioning, or able to function with support, like a ventilator,
yeah,
or able to function with a feeding tube or something like that, and I've got to say, this understanding of brain death is directly related to our process of organ transplant.
To the relatively recent development of being able to take organs from a dying person and put them into a living person.
And so this understanding of death is functionally what allows us to ethically engage in organ transplant.
There's a great quote that mentions Peter Singer, philosopher.
Yes.
Who's not exactly known for his
pro-life views. No, you wouldn't describe him that way, though.
Not at all. And he's often attacked from the right by conservatives, like saying, "Can you believe this guy?" But actually, I find him to be quite interesting. You know, I don't always agree.
Oh, he's really interesting. Yes.
But I think he's a real thinker. You know, and his view on this, he described it, quote, "a concept so desirable in its consequences that it is unthinkable to give up, and so shaky on its foundations that it can scarcely be supported."
Right.
The new death was, quote, "an ethical choice masquerading as a medical fact."
Precisely.
And I think that's exactly true.
That's exactly true.
Because I do not, I mean, to really consider the body as a system, a human life as a system, I don't have a strong degree of confidence that it's possible to draw a really bright line and say, we know with absolute certainty that on one side of this line, a person is alive, and on the other side, a person is dead. I just don't think the body works that way.
It doesn't work that way. And you really can't honestly say that as a fact.
There's a lot of cases are obviously clear cut, right?
Like on an individual basis, right?
Yeah.
Right, certainly.
But, in your own family, you tell the story of your mother who was badly injured.
She was very badly injured. In 1990, my mother was run over by a car.
Yeah.
And she was brought to the hospital. Ambulance came, took her to the hospital, et cetera.
Yeah.
My oldest brother, who was a physician,
right,
went to find her. Because, he came home from work. Because, where's mom? Oh, let me tell you. And no one was quite sure what hospital she was at. So he just started going to hospitals. So he went to the first hospital. And this was before you would just call on your cell phone, right? And when he got there, she was there.
Yes.
He happened to have the good fortune to be on staff at that hospital.
Uh-huh.
And he found her in the morgue.
Yeah.
They had tagged her as dead and left her body in the morgue. But he felt and found a pulse.
Mm-hmm.
And she was steaming up his mirror. She was breathing.
She was breathing.
She had shallow breathing and a shallow pulse.
She was in severe shock and had suffered some horrific injuries.
So really horrific. I mean, the car ran over her twice, actually. And so he, since he was on staff, was in the morgue, got an orderly and said, "Let's bring this woman up to the emergency room. She needs immediate care. She's breathing. She has a pulse."
Yeah.
And she lived another 22 years after that.
Yeah, and she wasn't, just to be clear, she didn't just live another 22 years. Like, she woke up and was a functional person.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
she woke up. She walked again.
She walked again. Now, she did have long-term injuries.
She had long-term injuries, long-term mobility problems.
Scooter. But she wasn't,
She wasn't in a persistent vegetative state.
No.
By a long shot.
I mean, we had meals that she cooked and conversations
that we had.
She spent time with her grandchildren, watched TV,
hung out, built a garden. Actually, that was before she ever went to Saginaw and built that huge garden and all the work she did in Saginaw.
Right. So
this was 10 years before that. Yeah.
So I'm like, there was no, like, it didn't continue to be, well, she's near death, you know.
No, it didn't stay in that liminal space.
No, at all.
But a decision was made.
That she was dead.
That she was actually dead. And she was sent to the morgue.
Hard. And I think this happens more often than people would like to.
Yeah.
To
because
believe.
Let's pretend for a minute that we were a different family.
Yeah.
And let's pretend that my oldest brother wasn't a physician, or let's just pretend he wasn't on staff at that hospital.
Right. Right. Some detail changed.
Some detail of this story changed. She probably wouldn't have gotten out of that morgue.
No.
So
at some point that the you know, probably within another hour or even less.
Less. She wouldn't have been breathing
her,
or
like,
pulse anymore. Right.
The label they gave her would have become true.
Right. So, yes. And what we had, what we used to have, was this cardiorespiratory failure. That's the only way you die. Your heart's not beating, and you're not breathing. So in other words, the two tests that Jim performed.
Right.
Is she fogging?
The more traditional.
Right. Is she fogging up a mirror?
Determination of what?
Can I feel a pulse?
Right.
And he felt a pulse, and she fogged up a mirror. So he initiated resuscitation, which ultimately worked. And yes, it was a very hard row to hoe. But yes, the advent of the modern ventilator, this oxygen treatment, coincided with the advent of the ability to perform organ transplants.
Yes.
And they kind of developed in tandem and supported each other, where to give birth to this new understanding of death as brain function.
Yeah.
And maybe they performed those brain function tests for my mom and she wasn't responsive. I don't know. And who knows? I don't know.
I mean, I suspect that they may have done, you know, like shouted at her and, you know.
Or something. Or I have no idea.
Yeah. And maybe the pulse, you know, became stronger after she, you know, like after a while.
After a while, right?
Maybe she recuperated a little bit. Maybe at the time they were trying to measure a pulse, it was really, really,
really
weak.
And then they couldn't find one or whatever.
I don't know. But anyway, it's quite interesting. I think you and I are actually a little bit split about the issue of organ donation.
Yes, I'm not in favor of organ donation if the person has to be alive to donate the organ.
So that leaves stuff like, I think...
Well, let me put it this way. I should rephrase that. So I would, personally, would happily donate a kidney to a stranger. I wouldn't think twice.
Right.
I personally would encourage any healthy person to do so.
The line you draw is that if you still meet the traditional definition of being alive,
you get to keep it.
You get to keep it.
Yeah.
And I think you may be winning me over gradually, because I'm kind of like, well, you know, if a person's brain dead, but I'm a case like this suggests to me that the general accepted concept of brain death is too vague.
It's just too vague.
And it may not be very accurate.
And let's be very clear. We embrace it and we defend it vigorously, because it's the only leg organ transplant has to stand on.
I think that may be true.
Right.
But I also believe that if organ transplantation didn't create this definition of death, that the for-profit health industry
likely would.
Would do it, would promote a similar concept.
So they can stop paying.
So they can stop paying for care. So that they they can develop an ethical, you know, a definition of life that where the medical ethics behind it fit nicely with their fiduciary responsibility to shareholders. Right?
Yes. Yes. It's hard. You mentioned that last night, and it's actually hard for me to not see that emerge. It's always interesting how our ethics really seem to fall in line with, like, you know, the financial interests of people who are wealthy.
Now,
kind of like the church used to be against usury.
Yeah, yeah.
Flat up, straight out, no usury. It's a sin.
But this also, so
now the church engages in usury.
This, has, I think there's a connection to the way that you've talked about how the church does not embrace the death penalty under Correct. Any circumstances, right? However,
right.
there is a circumstance in traditional church writing and teaching.
I've tried to be clear about that. Yeah. The church does not embrace the death penalty as a right to kill.
Yes.
The church only understands the death penalty in the context of a right to self-defense.
As a right to self-defense.
That
right. In other words, if you, let's say you can't, you know, take care of this person in your town or village or whatnot who's killing people.
Just keeps killing people. Jeffrey Dahmer keeps getting out of his cage.
Yeah.
And every time
you do
dies.
Have an affirmative right to kill this person in self-defense if nothing else is going to protect your life.
If nothing else is going to protect the life of the community.
The life of the lives in the community.
Then the community has that right to self-defense.
Right.
And that's the only ethical frame under which the church understands the death penalty.
Now people are... Okay, this... Hear me out.
I'm going to hear you out. Yeah, I'm always ready.
So, this... I made a notation here.
Okay.
Yeah. Nyla said that the cost of care was roughly $150,000 a week.
Yeah.
So people will be making...
The claim.
The claim that keeping this young woman alive...
Mm-hmm.
Well... Not let's just say not removing her
not
life support.
Not removing her life support, yes.
Is too costly. And
sure.
this expense, this ongoing expense is harming the community. It's taking resources away from other patients, it's taking resources away from whatever. We're mm-hmm. the richest country in the world, but basically we can't afford to keep this black girl alive.
It's expensive. Yeah.
Or again, alive.
Such as it is.
Such as it is. But so people will make that argument.
Certainly.
It's a lot like the I see it as a lot like the argument about welfare queens and con
oh, right.
artists, why we have to kick these people off welfare and get them back to work. Right?
That's an argument. It is an argument. It's a legitimate argument, but I think it's a disingenuous legitimate argument because
yes.
it's too shallow.
It's too... Say.
So... Let's go back to our example of the death penalty, right? Where you have a right to defend yourself, right?
Yes.
So is the claim that this $100,000 a week is killing people? Is that the claim? That it's killing the community?
Right.
And people are dying because of this $100,000?
It's similar to the argument that, well, if we don't kill these inmates, the taxpayers have to pay to feed them and,
Precisely.
And house them.
Precisely.
You know.
Incidentally, it's less expensive to do that than it is to
Right,
pursue
because
death.
The death penalty litigation and all that is so
far outstrips
expensive.
The cost of keeping them alive.
Yes.
Right. And I would maintain that the process to remove someone's life support, if we had a different understanding of death,
right,
would far outstrip the cost to the community of keeping them alive.
Yeah.
In a very similar way. That said, all that said, it is fundamentally disingenuous to claim that her medical care is killing our
sure.
national community.
Right.
That the cost of her medical care is actually killing us.
No.
That's just a lie. Because if that's actually killing us, then it's actually killing us to allow corporations not to pay any of their damn taxes.
Right.
If that is actually killing us.
Right. It's not.
It's like the distraction of
yes,
saying
it,
that,
it
you
is,
know.
It is expensive, and it is an ongoing
And I don't
thing.
Deny that it's expensive. I don't deny that it's ongoing.
But this is honestly a matter of priorities. I want to go from there a little bit.
I had one sort of righteous claim I had to make. Though.
Please, make your outrageous claim.
Not outrageous, righteous.
Oh, righteous.
My righteous claim is that that's as genuine as the assertion that we've got to balance the budget on the food stamp. Benefit.
Oh, right.
It is one half of 1%
right.
of the budget.
Right.
Shut up and go home with that. If
right.
you just don't like poor people, go ahead and make your argument about how much you hate poor people.
But
don't
be honest about it.
Don't lie about how right. this is critical to our financial health.
Right.
Because if you want to talk about how keeping this girl alive is going to bankrupt us,
right.
if that's honestly your argument, then we need to have a long talk about the Pentagon.
Yeah.
So...
So the family has kept kept this girl alive.
Yes.
With this medical intervention that's quite costly. And over time, you want me to talk about what state she's in now, or do you want to talk about it?
Oh, you can go ahead and talk about it, yeah.
Because I feel a little diffident, is that the word?
Maybe.
So she, there's a few things that have become clear.
Yeah.
She responds to spoken commands.
Yes.
Right? There is still an interior...
There's some interior life happening.
Life happening in which this girl is now capable of responding to commands.
Right.
And so, for example, my favorite bit is when her mother would say, "Show us which finger you would use to tell someone to F off."
Right.
And she would very slowly, after a delay, like move her middle finger.
Right.
Right. So clearly something's going on.
Right.
She can interpret these statements.
Right. That's not a yes, no. That's a...
Yeah.
That's a lot. That's a significant feedback loop.
And they have video. Shot a lot of video of her responding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I guess, a little questionable about what's going on, because it's also... they've shot a lot of video and they've captured a few moments where she seems to respond quickly to a command or a stimulus in a way that makes it really
clear
to an outside observer that she's responding specifically to this thing.
Right.
But when other people try and interact with her, maybe they say something, maybe 20 seconds later, she has a movement or something.
Right.
And so it's not, that's, I guess, diffident. Like, I'm not fully convinced that she's reliably hearing and understanding and responding to stimuli. So there is, I'm convinced there is some functioning going on where she hears something and she responds and she can interpret words.
Right.
Her mom claims she has conversations where she signals yes and no with her fingers.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure whether that's really happened or whether the parents have kind of trained her and trained themselves to believe
what's happening. Or it's hard to say.
It's a little hard to say. You agree that it's a little loose, a little vague. Like you can't reliably say, you know, move this finger, she moves this finger, move that finger, she moves that finger. There's these long delays and it's not easily reproducible.
Right.
And that most of the day, she's not responsive, but you may get her in a window where she's responsive for a while, like she's more awake.
Right. And actually one of the medical professionals I spoke with spoke about that.
Yeah.
That, you know, it's not actually surprising that she might be semi-conscious or unconscious.
Unconscious most of the day.
Most of the time, most of the day. Like, you know, 20 hours out of 24. And there's a window occasionally that you may or may not be able to catch when she's conscious enough to engage with you.
Yeah.
That's not hard to believe or imagine.
So, but something that seemed also very promising and not so ambiguous was that they had a Calixto Machado, the president of the Cuban Society of Clinical Neurophysiology.
Yeah.
And this person came out and did some scans and discovered that, you know, normally for someone who's been actually only alive because of a ventilator for this long, you would have expected and had undergone true brain death.
Yeah. What they're specifically referring to as brain death.
You would have expected to see that the brain had largely liquefied, literally had just, there were no blood flow to the brain. All those cells died. It's just kind of a sludge in there. Sometimes they even calcify. Right.
Right.
And what this Dr. Machado said is that the recent scans show that there is still
Right, the nerve fibers that connect the brain's right and left hemispheres were barely recognizable, but large areas of her cerebrum, which mediates consciousness, language, and voluntary movements, were structurally intact.
And Dolan shouted, she's got a brain.
She has a brain.
Right. Now, Mikado, but there is still like a lot of damage to the brain stem.
Yes, which is the part that would actually
allow her voluntary control over her body.
Right. And or like full voluntary. Like
full voluntary
control. And like allow her to breathe on her own.
Right.
Right.
And Machado also did various tests like... noted that her parasympathetic responses, like her heart rate, change mm-hmm. when her mother speaks to her.
Right.
And said, you know, when her mother says, I love you, everyone is proud of you, her heart rate changes. And Machado notes that this is not found, this responsiveness is not found in a patient that's truly brain dead.
Right.
So, meanwhile, they're trying to get California... to overturn the death certificate.
Because, yeah. it seems absurd that they would find her brain dead under these circumstances now.
So, yeah, it does seem absurd, but they didn't apparently think there was enough evidence.
Well, the time has elapsed.
She's been dead too long. Like, well, yeah, if you leave her dead even longer, maybe she'll be even less dead, right?
Okay, so we can just keep going, I guess. Right.
So it's really puzzling, though, because you do have to ask yourself, what are her prospects for any kind of...
Anything. What?
For anything. Like, what is going to be achieved the longer she stays in this condition, in this situation? And what the article is suggesting is that some degree of recovery may be possible.
Maybe.
But will she ever be able to speak clearly?
It's a very long shot.
It's a long shot. It really is a long shot. Will she ever be able to speak?
A long, slow shot.
I mean, probably she'd never be able to walk. Let's rule out a lot of, you know.
Yeah, maybe, you know.
But, and they're also, I was encouraged to read that her family is trying to get her to provide some feedback on
what she wants, how she feels about what's going on and what we're doing. Yeah,
whether she feels like her experience in this almost locked in condition mm-hmm. is something she wants to continue, or if she's unhappy.
Unhappy like this, right? Well, did you get to the part about the one young man that was in a similar state where you could credibly describe him as brain dead after the incident, and he was 4. He lived another 20 years because he was able to stay on a ventilator.
He lived 20 years. Was this the guy whose brain actually was calcified?
Yeah, yeah. And this is apparently the diagnosis was correct. His brain actually did start to deteriorate even further. He lived another 20 years on a ventilator.
The outside of his brain had calcified. His heart beat for 24 more years, during which time he grew proportionally and recovered from minor wounds and infections.
Yeah. So it's hard to say what the prospects are. I don't care to comment on the utility or value
of a life.
Or to suggest that...
Yeah, we were having this conversation last night. What's the utilitarian argument?
I don't care to make
we're
any...
We're not Pete Singer.
I don't care to make any utilitarian argument. I'm not going to make any comment in that respect. Because I know that the value I get from my children in my life is irreplaceable and cannot be counted.
So this guy Schumann.
So you know, that's not someplace I'm really ready to go.
Yeah.
Schumann. What about Schumann?
Oh, this guy Schumann. He said he was one of the people responsible for the modern concept of brain death.
Yes.
Right. He has now. He said that he has dissented.
Dissented from cancer.
From his ideas about brain death, and it's the reason that he has is in part because he's seen so many cases where people survive. Right.
They actually weren't dead the way we described them dead.
In a sense. So, and he said, his quote, he has disavowed his earlier views. He published a paper called recovery from, quote, brain death, unquote, a neurologist's apologia. Mm-hmm. And he said that dissenters from the brain death concept are typically dismissed condescendingly as simpletons, religious zealots, or pro-life fanatics, and announced that he's joining their ranks.
That's me too. Thank you. Yeah. And it hinges on what he calls chronic survival. They keep surviving.
Chronic survival. I thought that was just a beautifully ironic, ridiculous term.
Right. They just keep going.
Yeah.
Somehow, some way, keep going.
Meanwhile, and they're trying to file their taxes.
And they can't because apparently she's dead and they can't claim her.
The IRS is saying they can't claim her as a dependent.
And she's like, I don't want to fight the IRS.
No, God.
No. Yeah.
They're filed a malpractice lawsuit against the Children's Hospital seeking damages for pain and suffering.
Yeah, there's no pain and suffering for a corpse.
The hospital argued that deceased bodies do not have legal standing to sue.
Just saying.
They're saying plaintiffs are preserving Jahi's body. Again, basically saying this is a corpse. She's dead.
She's
dead. And there's no doubt. From its natural post-mortem course, it would be against public policy to hold health professionals liable for the costs of futile medical interventions performed on a dead person. And they even made this, I thought, really enraging argument that asking any medical professional, nursing staff or whatnot to work on her care would be traumatic, emotionally traumatic for these people, and unfair to subject them to this kind of trauma. Mm. So caring for a dead person is too ghoulish.
It's awful. So I'm not prepared to tell any parent that if they want to receive care for their child, I'm on their team.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm really not prepared to say, well, she's not responsive. Well, she's not this. Well, she's not that. Well, she's got this problem. I don't think it's worth pursuing.
And I'm not ethically willing to follow the utilitarian argument to its logical conclusion.
No.
Because you know what? Someone could make the case that I'm 50 years old and I just don't have that much
use left.
Use left in
you
me.
Really, what do you got to give society?
I don't feel that I have that much use left in me, right? So, you know, what's to keep me from just having my life declared completed?
And just shuffling off, you know?
The state decides that they're going to pay for my euthanasia, but not any health care.
Any health care. Because, you know, we can't really make any use of you anymore.
Right. So I'm not comfortable with that utilitarian argument.
No. I am not. And it's largely this idea that you can quantify somebody's experience of love for a family member.
For a family member. No, I don't think you can.
But you can, there's some kind of something you can put on that. It's just, I don't think it's even possible to count that.
No.
Right? And there's something going on that the author of this article mentions, okay, so maybe the family's got this joint delusion.
Folie a famille.
Right.
It's like folie à deux, except shared by a whole family.
A whole family. And they're all imagining that she's responding and engaging, and they're all imagining that she's alive. And the family's engaged in this joint delusion together. Except...
I wouldn't call it a delusion, but I do think they are probably feeding and supporting each other's optimistic bias.
I would grant that 100%.
Yeah.
That they are... feeding each other optimistic bias,
right,
which is actually a healthy thing that families
do. It's what families do for each other.
Right. It's a healthy, and actually, it's a healthy thing that you do for each other in times of crisis.
Yeah.
There's no way you can survive this, but you know what? We got each other. We're doing okay. It's fine. Keep going, everybody. Keep walking.
But even with all this support, like it mentions that the mother is suffering from severe depression and anxiety at
all
this
kinds
point,
of issues,
you
right?
Know. I can't imagine
how you could survive and not have these effects on your health.
Right.
But if the family is experiencing this delusion, every nurse that cares for her is experiencing this delusion. Every medical professional not affiliated with the hospital or the state of California is also experiencing this delusion.
What do you think? Do you remember who was the child that was horribly bludgeoned? killed in Mississippi in the 70s.
Oh.
And the parents insisted on having an open casket funeral to show the world.
Oh, Emmett Till. That was the 60s. That was like okay, the 50s.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Emmett Till. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I couldn't. That's who I was thinking of, but I'm sorry that I couldn't come up with a name.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's an aspect of this in which the parents are basically saying, and I support them in this, this is our open casket funeral. You motherfuckers are going to have to look at what you've done. And you don't get to just bury it.
Oh, I think there's, I don't think that's a conscious element, but I think that's there.
Yeah, I do too.
Right.
But I think...
Like, it's between the lines here in the article.
Yeah.
And they just barely skim it when they talk about it
well,
at the hospital.
Well, of course, the New Yorker is targeted at white liberals who couldn't possibly be racist, and a lot of their friends and family are medical professionals who couldn't possibly be racist.
Or bigoted in any way.
Yeah.
But no, there's really this, like, no, we're not donating organs. What happened?
Yes.
And this whole...
No one's taken responsibility. And that was the exact experience, actually. My rage and your rage, too, I think, when Covenant...
Oh, that was St. Mary's.
I'm sorry.
St. Mary's Hospital in Saginaw, Michigan.
Nearly killed you.
Yes.
With neglect.
Right.
Failed to notice that your blood pressure had dropped to nothing and that you were, you know... You couldn't speak. You were unconscious.
I was so, really close.
So this girl died. Well, okay.
Achieved brain death.
Well, except that there, one of the people interviewed in the article says, now I think we should think of brain death as a severe trauma that happens to the brain, not as a state that it enters and stays.
Right.
Necessarily. Like right.
So,
but this girl, her brain injury, I believe, probably came about because of severe blood loss.
Correct.
And
that seems consistent.
And then that also triggered her heart to stop, you know, because if your heart doesn't have any blood to pump at some point, it can't.
It can't. Right.
And her blood oxygenation level went way down. Well, you were bleeding internally.
Yes.
Your blood pressure dropped to, what was it, some...
It was
50 over 30
low.
Or something like that.
Yeah, it was like, I think it was 40.
Your heart almost, had it gone on much longer, your heart would have given up.
Right. And actually, I was conscious. I was conscious. I did not lose consciousness.
You didn't.
I tried to go to the bathroom and I was feeling really
You couldn't
weird.
Walk.
I couldn't walk. And I was just had this sort of weird sensation, like not quite vertigo, but just I knew I wasn't well. I couldn't figure out how. And I thought I needed to go to the bathroom.
The blood flow to your brain was dropping. A stone.
And when I tried to get up, I since I felt so weird, I asked an orderly to help me.
Yeah.
And I just collapsed. And he got me back into bed. And he looked at me and called. He did not call a code, but he called like an emergency team.
Yeah.
That I can't remember. There's some kind of name they have for this team. And it's like a physician, a nurse, a couple of other, like a nurse practitioner. And they come and do an evaluation and any kind of emergency intervention. It's basically like a small emergency room team.
Yeah.
And
he had the presence of mind to notice that you definitely weren't looking well.
She's not looking well. And that we need the emergency team.
Yeah. And they did not, they pumped up your blood pressure using saline.
Yeah, there's added saline to move my blood pressure up.
To get your blood pressure going in the right direction because you were crashing.
Because I was crashing. And I do recall that this team came in and they were kind of like, so what do you think's happening? Why do you think it's happening? And they were kind of going back and forth a little bit. And at that moment, the oldest person on the team, who was a nurse, said, gentlemen, this woman's going to die in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
We have to get her blood pressure back up.
Yeah.
And so they did.
But they can bicker about it later.
We can bicker about what's happening later. Yeah. But right now, she needs her blood pressure back up to survive. So let's take care of that.
That this whole thing got to this point because they were not watching you adequately.
No.
And not...
And various complaints and so on. We're like, is that okay? Is that normal?
Not doing anything about the fact that you were clearly bleeding internally.
Right. And then and kept saying, oh, I don't think there's any problem. I don't think like you're bleeding internally. When I asked it, so that team came... I was in bad shape. What's going on here? Like, oh, I don't think anything's going on. I don't think there's a problem. By the way, would you sign this form? Because we got to give you like 4 units of blood.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what do I need 4? And actually at that point I said, I'm not signing the form. What do I need 4 units of blood for?
Well, you're bleeding internally.
Exactly. But they would actually not admit to me that I was bleeding internally. This is like, oh, there's nothing wrong. We just need to give you some blood products.
And then this was exactly the thing. The best I could do to get someone to admit that this didn't go as planned was when I got one older doctor to say, no, you're right, it's not supposed to go like this. It's not supposed really to go like not this. Supposed to go like this.
This is not a normal.
This is not a normal thing. But no one would admit. This is, and this is a medical professional stonewall, and that's what they do. It's what they're trained to do.
For liability reasons.
For liability reasons. They won't admit anything. I absolutely don't have to.
Right.
And they'll hide, they'll lose your records, which they did. They hid your records. There was a record of your blood pressure drop.
Right.
There was a record of these interventions. They disappeared from your records by the time I was trying to get copies in order to take to an attorney.
Imagine that. So, and that, if you look at their story, and they say themselves, would this have turned out this way if they had treated us with any compassion or dignity?
Compassion, respect. I mean, they talk about how a couple nurses seemed concerned that this girl was spitting up an awful lot of blood, right?
Like, well, don't change her blood. Her gown, like, what? So you can observe the blood loss? Okay.
Yeah. Well, that actually made sense to me.
It made some sense.
She was bleeding, but she was neglected.
Observation is not the same as action.
Right. In my opinion, she was neglected, and in my opinion, she was neglected probably because white medical staff do not see black people among them as fully human.
Full stop. Yeah. And I think this is a case, a textbook case of that.
Yeah.
And so what does this mean? And for me, all these end of life decisions, people have various utilitarian conversations.
Yeah.
And they have various like science and rationalist conversations. And they have all manner and kind of ideas about the idea. Right?
Yeah.
They have all kinds of thoughts about the idea.
Right.
But the fact, and the only bottom line that I'm interested in, is how this frame affects the marginalized.
Yes.
And if it's going to harm the marginalized, you're wrong.
It's wrong.
You're just wrong.
You're using the wrong intellectual framework.
Whatever your scaffolding is, whatever your idea is, it's wrong. If the net outcome...
We start with the marginalized.
That's where you start.
Rather than, well, it works really well for wealthy white liberals.
For me. Right?
Right. And there's comment about how, you know, our definition of brain death was very appealing to intellectuals, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who live in their brains, who value intellectual work above everything else.
Right.
But other cultures, other societies, other faiths, might think of life and death is more of a physical, like, what's your body doing?
What's your body doing?
Not, are you going to be able to write an essay again? Are you going to write another piece for JAMA?
Can you get published? I'm just asking. Yeah. Well, you're not, what's that joke? So are they, is he viable yet? I don't know. He hasn't graduated medical school.
Right. So that's how you know when the
child's viable.
When the child's finally viable.
Right. So that's not the frame that everyone's operating with.
Yeah.
And I don't think it should be, right?
I think that a diversity of frames and a diversity of views, you know, if your definition of life and death can't accommodate a diversity of human views and it's not big enough.
It's not big enough. Yeah. And I think this is what I'd like to my last note.
You'd like to end on.
Yeah. I think clearly every person that's not affiliated with the hospital, that's engaged, largely every person that's engaged with Jahi on a day-to-day basis now, is experiencing her as alive.
As alive to some extent.
To some extent. Yeah. They have an experience of her as
clearly
alive.
Not dead.
Yeah, she's clearly not dead. As one person said, I forget which one, was it Schumann? Said she's profoundly disabled, but alive.
That was an interesting phrasing too. Yeah, no, in best case, you know, she's profoundly disabled.
But she's alive.
But We don't kill our helpless disabled people.
We just don't do that.
Yeah.
And I think certainly the people with a vested interest in her not being alive aren't having that experience.
Yes.
Right? And there were certainly people, like someone called it an anonymous tip to the officers that...
They actually sent police officers into her house.
Because they told
the officers they're harboring a dead body.
The officers
came in and like saw this girl on a ventilator and they're like, I don't see a dead body.
And so,
but no, this is how nasty human beings are to each other over ideas like this.
Over ideas like this, yeah.
It's like being swatted.
It's really kind of perverse. But I think people who are engaged with her day to day,
yeah,
are experiencing her as alive.
Right.
And I. That's probably enough.
That's probably enough.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's where we're at.
All right. You have any nasty comments?
Bring it.
Bring it. We'd love to hear them.
Yeah.
No, read the
article. Well, the nice ones, too. Read the article.
Nice read the article. I mean, we didn't write any of this. We're just talking about it.
And yeah, we'd love to hear what you have to say. And you can disagree or not. It's cool with me.
And I'm, like I said, I'm trying not to be dogmatic because just about everything I thought I believed about organ donation and brain death and all that, I'm a little skeptical of these days.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's.
All right. I'm still planning to donate my organs.
Do what you gotta do.
But yeah. Okay, yeah, everybody.
Have a good week.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Bye bye.
Take care.